I'm speaking today with Larry Joe Daugherty, a Democratic candidate for Congressional District 10, which stretches from Harris to Travis counties. Larry Joe, we talked back in February when you were running in a primary for this race, and so I'm going to ask you again what I asked you back
then.
Seems like
yesterday.
It does, doesn't it? Why are you running for this particular office?
Well, this district has been misrepresented. It's been misrepresented in its construction by Tom DeLay to cheat the people of Travis County out of their choice of representative. And it's been misrepresented by the rubber stamp that has been put in office to play a role dictated by others. And you know, Chuck, can I call you Chuck?
Yes, you may. Thank you.
I made a career out of holding lawyers accountable and responsible for legal malpractice. And that's just another way of saying misrepresenting their clients. So to me, it's natural to want to do something about a lawyer. Michael McCall's a lawyer, even though he's also a representative. When he's not doing the job that the people deserve, the people want, and the people need, the only way to hold him accountable is to replace him. I can't sue him for legal malpractice, but he doesn't put the people's interests above his own. And a lawyer in a legal context would be required to do that because he's a fiduciary. A congressman should do that because he has a conscience and a heart. And the people of District 10 have not had their interests put in front of Michael McCall's. Instead, he puts the interests of government, the Republican Party, and corporations in front of the interests of the people who elected him to office.
Now, as we speak today, it's, you know, getting close to Election Day, and I would say the issue that's probably on most people's mind is the economy. You know, the stock market has been tanking.
Yeah.
The housing market is down. The financial industry is in shambles. You know, what should Congress be doing about this when, you know, the next Congress gets together in 2009?
Well, let's not forget, just because the pinch is tighter on one toe than the other, that the economy and the war are inextricably intertwined. It's a common problem with two heads. We're not going to solve the war by chunking more money at it, and we're not going to fix the problems of this economy as long as we're hemorrhaging money in Iraq. You want an economic stimulus package? Tell the people that we're getting out of Iraq, and we're starting now, and we're going to keep getting out of Iraq until we are completely out of Iraq, and we quit spending billions of dollars per day on a war that was ill-conceived and is ill-executed as well. So, when I get to Congress and we're still dealing with the economic mess, we're gonna look at alternative uses of the investment of the tax dollars that should be being spent to grow jobs and to produce in the economy. And instead, we're in an economic meltdown because the energies of our industry have gone to produce paper, deals, side bets, credit default swaps, things that collapsed that had no value to begin with, and they produced no product, they produced no jobs, they served no interest in stimulating the economy, but they drove the borrow and spend agenda of the Republican Party to its height. And the cruelest tax we've had imposed on us is the borrowing that the Republican Party has done to provide more capital, more borrowing, more spending, 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 more borrowing. That's a false economy. We're going to have to produce our way out of this mess. We're going to have to create jobs. Alternative energy sources will create jobs, and investment in education will create jobs. Investment in health care will create jobs. And those are all things that we've got to have, or we're going to collapse as an economy.
All right. You talked at length about the Iraq war when we spoke during the primary season. At this point, I would say that the general consensus has moved towards the Obama plan of getting out over the next year and a half or so. How would you like to see that go, and where should the U.S. be focusing its efforts in prosecuting the, you know, the greater war on terror.
Well, we've taken our eye off the ball by moving the focus of our military operation out of Afghanistan and by abdicating the responsibility to take out Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden himself, when that opportunity presented itself, and focusing over on taking out Saddam Hussein instead. We took our eye off of the objective. We let the military determine what needs to be done to get reoriented on the war on terror in Afghanistan. But ultimately, terrorism is a police-oriented function. It's best combated by investment in better police intelligence activities than in marshaling a military. All of the experts agree that you don't fight the kind of war on terror that we have with a military. You fight it with intelligence and with police activity and with public consciousness and awareness. I dare say we're never going to be so complacent again as Americans not to be concerned about our security. And with involvement of the public in what's being done in their communities, where people are no longer just buffeted about by strangers, we can deal with homeland security and make America a more secure homeland.
So to talk about that, one of the actions that Congress recently took with the support of members of both parties was to redo the FISA legislation and allow for greater expansion of warrantless wiretapping. That was very controversial among, you know, progressives on the Democratic side.
We don't protect constitutional rights by destroying them. That's outrageously counterintuitive. I was strongly opposed to that.
What specifically would you like to see Congress do to, you know, fix the bad parts of that legislation? Or do you think it should just be thrown out in its entirety?
Well, what they did was remove the responsibility of the operatives from going to a special court to show that there was justification for the wiretapping in the first place. And that kind of constitutional protection needs to be reinitiated, put back into the FISA legislation. There was even a provision in there where that if they didn't have time to act, I mean, if that really was going to stop a surveillance activity, they could go to the court subsequently and say, looky, we did a good thing, and here's why we did it, and ask the blessing to keep the fruit of the tree. That safeguard seems ample enough to me. The powers that did away with those safeguards simply didn't want to have to go to the trouble of that kind of carelessness breeds an unconcern for the rights of the citizens, and it's shown, yeah, they've been using their power to look at stuff they're not supposed to look at, and we were supposed to trust them.
Okay. More recently, Congress voted to provide what's been termed either a bailout or a rescue to the financial firms in the wake of that collapse on Wall Street. That too has been controversial and has, you know, generated a lot of criticism on, you know, both the left and the right. What is your take on this, and what, if anything, would you like to see done in the future about it?
Are you talking about everything from the takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to the $700 billion bailout, or just the last act, the $700 billion bailout?
I was referring specifically to the bailout, but feel free to address Fannie Mae if you'd like.
Maybe I should call it just the latest act. I don't think it's the last act. We haven't seen Visa, MasterCard, and American Express come begging for a government bailout on the extension of credit or the loss of funds that are going to come from credit card overuse and abuse, or for their excessive charges of interest to people who get caught in a credit pinch and haven't read the fine print in their contracts. But that shoe is yet to fall, and I clearly see it coming. I think the $700 billion bailout was an unfortunate stacking of opportunity to promote default or to allow default in home mortgages, with protection of the people who had the most to gain out of it. The ones that were trying to socialize risk succeeded in doing so. And that's what we've done. We've privatized their profit. The ones that took their money and fled and got their golden parachutes are gone. Their privatized profit has inured to their benefit. And our government has begun to embrace a program of not socialism, but corporate socialism. We're only bailing out the big boys in corporate America. And I am no more in favor of that than I am in going to Las Vegas and bailing out the big rich gamblers who lose the most. That's all the credit default swaps was a side bet on another deal based on what everybody could easily have seen, except Alan Greenspan, was going to collapse around them. And now Greenspan says, I made a mistake. Yeah. Well, that doesn't do the citizens any good. So we might get lucky, though, and they might not have to spend $700 billion to bail out defaulted mortgages. But they're going to have already spent $150 billion to get the congressman that voted for it to go along with it. And that kind of lagniappe or sweetener is almost the same thing as bribery. If the bill is good enough for the benefit of the American people, why can't Congress come together and pass a $700 billion bailout program without having to have $150 billion of earmarks added to it? That's offensive to me. I would have voted against it for that. I would have made them clean it up before I would have voted for it.
Okay. One of the issues that has arisen as a result of this is the question of whether or not financial institutions should be regulated in the way banks once were. Right now, it seems like almost anything can serve the function of a bank, and that was part of the problem that led to this fall. Would you like to see that revisited and perhaps put some more regulation back in the financial industry?
Well, yeah, I mean, it may have started before they did away with the Glass-Steagall Act, but if you saw 60 Minutes on TV last night, you know that in 2000, it was the legislation that allowed the deregulation of the industry to create the monsters that are now consuming us, called credit default swaps. And if that legislation had not included a provision called preemption, and man, it's tough for the public to see where a curveball's coming from. Most people have a difficult time understanding preemption when it's explained head on. But in this instance, it is an insidious, creeping device being used in federal legislation to make sure that states that want to regulate things like banks, insurance industries, corporations, litigation, are preempted and not allowed to, because the federal statute claims or provides that only the federal government can address the issue. And the federal government, of course, was busy emasculating the Securities and Exchange Commission and the other regulatory authorities that would have provided oversight if there was any oversight to be provided, and the states couldn't do it. And those credit default swaps would have been illegal under most gaming, anti-gaming statutes in most states, or at least in enough that it would have drawn fire. But the federal statute was drawn in the year 2000 and rushed through Congress just before the end of the session in 2000 to honor the free market, Chuck, the free market. You know, that was a great concept when there was a free market, but the market is the size of the globe. And the free world is not global. Is China free? Is Russia free? Is Venezuela free? Is Saudi Arabia free? Now, we may have some semblance of freedom in Europe and some other places in the world, but the market is bigger than that. We don't have free market economies. The laws of supply and demand don't work in structured economies where there is no free offer and exchange. And we're going to have to get away from the notion that free market economics are going to work anymore and build a government and build regulation around fair market. We can have capitalism and fair markets and supply the needs of all of the people in the United States and maybe champion a concept that will spread all over the world where capitalism is the preferred form of economic exchange. But it's got to be regulated. Unfettered, unregulated capitalism is only interested in the rich getting richer, the strongest surviving, the weakest perishing, and the profit being the motive.
Okay. Presumably, the next Congress will take up, hopefully, President Obama's health care plan. What would you like to see done in order to change the way health care is provided in the United States?
We need to get the insurance adjuster out from between the doctor and the patient. The doctor-patient relationship has been destroyed in America. Unless you pay for it with cash out of your hip pocket, you can have it if you pay cash. If you have insurance, you have to get the permission of your insurance company to determine if you've got covered event. And if you've got it covered, how much is covered? And is it experimental or is the doctor being prudent? The insurance adjuster can literally veto a recommended medical procedure. And to me, that is wrong. It is contrary to everything in medicine that doctors are taught is to be sacred for the medical practice. And we've allowed it to develop because it's become, it's evolved. From a system of trying to provide medical care as a perk of employment to now being a precondition to getting medical care. And if you don't have insurance, you go to the emergency room. Well, Chuck, we still pay for it. I don't care whether we pay for it with ad valorem taxes in the county emergency rooms or if we pay for it with higher priced automobiles because the insurance that is supplied to the union members causes General Motors to jack up the price of a Chevrolet a little bit more. We wind up paying for it. The question is how do we want to pay for it and how efficient do we want to be? The purpose of insurance is to make a profit. It's not to provide health care. As long as insurance stays involved in the provision of health care at the base level, people are not going to have basic health care needs met unless they have an emergency, and that means medical neglect. We're not going to have a healthy economy if we don't have a healthy country. If we don't have a workforce that's fit, we can't expect to have an economy that's driven and efficient. And if we have a healthy workforce, if we have a healthy citizenry, the cost of medical care will go down. You know, it's an illness treatment plan, not a wellness health care plan that we have in America.
You know, the Democrats regained control of Congress after the 2006 elections, and there were some fairly high hopes, I think, among both Democratic and progressive activists that they would be able to move the ball forward on a number of issues. And I think it's fair to say, going into the 2008 election, that you know, there's a lot of disappointment with what the most recent Congress did. Now, you've attracted the support of groups like Blue America PAC that doesn't just advocate electing Democrats, but advocates electing progressives to Congress. What do you think needs to be done to move Congress in a more progressive direction and to achieve some of the objectives that the Democratic Party says it stands for?
Well, without being issue specific, I think it's as fundamental as standing up for the rights of the people in a populist program that helps the people with the things that they cannot do for themselves, and does so unapologetically. If we provide the impetus for the courage to stand up for a public education system that's as good as it was in 1970, and to accept nothing less, and to not get caught up on the side issues of the economics of privatization, where they've tried to water down education with vouchers and to dilute the public education system. We can have a strong public education system again. If we're willing to stand up for health care as a fundamental right, a birthright in America, we can have it. And if we're willing to stand up for a clean drink of water as a birthright, instead of a commodity like oil that has to be paid, we can make a difference for the future as well. And if we don't, we're going to be in a water war that's going to make this oil crisis look like child's play.
We are about a week into early voting as I talk to you today, and I've seen that Mike McCall's camp is a little worried with how things are going so far. Can you, tell me a little bit about your take on how early voting has gone and what your camp is doing to get you elected?
Well, we have progressively, steadily messaged the constituency and received the continued improved endorsement of those people who are committed to going to vote and have not yet voted, and we expect to peak on election day with a victory.
So when people go to the ballot box and they come to the race for Texas Congressional District 10, how do you want people to think about it?
That they have an alternative, that they don't have to accept two more years of the same old non-representation that they've gotten the last 4 years. I want them to think that it makes a difference to vote for a change, and that they can have an opportunity to be a part of something bigger, better, and greater. I'm excited about the opportunity to be in Congress with an Obama agenda. I feel a lot younger just knowing that I'm blessed with the opportunity to be here today at this time in America, when it means so much to where we're going to take this country, and know that the power to make that change in the right direction is solely and completely within the hands of the Democratic Party, and that the Republicans have so completely and utterly blown any opportunity they had to do something good for America. But I'm eternally grateful that it only took George Bush 8 years to completely and totally screw it up.
All right. Larry Joe Daugherty, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you.